So let's begin with just go over quickly. We have the Mishnah Dav Zayin Amud Beis. What's the significance of this Mishnah? Kofin Oso Livnos Beishar Videlas Lachatzer. Kofin Oso Livnos Leir Chomad Lasayim Vavriach. So what do we take from this Mishnah? Why is it important? What do we get out of it? Romy?
Can force people to favor things?
Yeah. That you could enforce the constituents, members of a chatzer, and the members of an ear to pitch in for public goods. Yes? So it's a very low-key Mishnah, very understated, but this actually is a bedrock source for the idea in halacha that you could compel people to pitch in for public goods, which we're going to see in the tshuvos today. Very foundational concept. We still want to keep our eyes open conceptually as to what's the basis for that halachic right. The Mishnah establishes it. We still, Rav Elchanan was trying to see, what does this din itself depend on other dinim? I'm not really thrilled with Rav Elchanan's approach, like the Nesivus' approach better, that this principle is itself a foundational principle. But even if it's a foundational principle, we want to characterize what type of principle is it? Why do the B'nai Oyir have this right? Correct? So there is a lot of characterizing that has to be done on this Mishnah. Anybody have a thought on that before we... Okay. Let me just say a little more then. So you have the Toseftim B'Mitzia Perakid Aleph. These Toseftas are very helpful as well. I'm going to skip ahead here, actually, to this formulation. So Tosefta in Perakid Aleph, Tazayi, Hochet Tazayi, and Bab Mitzia. You have a whole series of dinim where the Tosefta talks about what the B'nai Ha'ir could compel each other to do. So let's just take a stab at Hochet Tazayi for a second. Josh, Kurt, want to read Hochet Tazayi? Yes, what does that mean?
So the people belonging to this mavoi don't want a tanner or a tailor to live amongst them.
Yeah. And so what could they do? They could compel each other
to not become that.
Yeah, exactly. They have this legal right to limit the types of professions that people in the chatzer could engage in. Okay? That's a pretty broad power that the B'nai HaMavoi have against each other. Do you agree, Josh?
Yes.
Yeah, so like in a zoning, you live in a community and they want to make a rule, no businesses allowed here, only residential homes. That's a power that the halacha gives to the community to decide for themselves. And you have this power to compel any yachid in the community to abide by that. Yes? Okay, so that's a very broad political power that the B'nai HaMavoi have. What else do we know from this this halacha? So let's look at halacha Yud Zayin. Let's talk about, what's that?
No.
Okay, B'nai Ha'ir. Mishab dinoso, Josh?
Mishab dinoso, lichbor imahin boros shichon ma'aros, v'takin atzamikos, v'amasamayim.
So this is the case which we saw last week. Right. If you own a property in a chatzer, even if you don't reside there, what could the B'nai HaChatzer compel you to do?
So these common uses, and, you know, everyone's responsible to chip in for the public goods.
Yeah, sewage, water. Yeah, public utilities.
Utilities.
Right? Does everybody see that? So that's another political or social power that the B'nai HaMavoi have, the B'nai HaChatzer have, that's enumerated explicitly in the Tosefta. So it's actually kind of surprising that this doesn't make its way explicitly into the Bavli. It's a very basic halachic principle. Maybe the expectation is that everybody is supposed to read the Tosefta separately. But this adds light, this sheds, gives us further information about what powers the B'nai HaChatzer have. Halacha Yud Ches. Josh? Yeah, so what's that?
So they're responsible in creating the... for completing the mavoi with alachi or korah.
Yeah, what's the significance of alachi and korah? What does it allow?
Carrying in the alley.
Yeah, carrying in the alley on Shabbos. So this is not a utility. This is a different type of public good. I guess a ritual necessity that people should be able to carry there on Shabbos. And this is actually very important. If you saw from the tshuvos today, that this gives you a sense that Lachi Nakora, it's not going to destroy life if you can't carry on Shabbos, but yet you could compel people to chip in for that. Correct? So this example is important because it downgrades the type of necessity that you could compel each other on. And I think that came up explicitly in the tshuvos that we're going to look at later. Okay? So the examples brought here are quite informative. Kofin b'nei bika, Josh?
Kofin b'nei bika, that's a lot. So it's b'nei ankaret, so b'nei ankaret.
So do we know what these are?
The ditch.
Yeah, what's the ditch for?
I think to keep out some animals.
Yeah, maybe to keep out animals, some border. Ned, do you have something else in mind? Maybe a water carrying ditch also, like irrigation. It's hard to know exactly, but the b'nei bika, so people who have joined fields, or they have neighboring fields, they can compel each other to chip in for this public good. I just want to point out that it's actually not so clear from the Tosefta whether it's limited to compelling the people to chip in financially or even for physical labor. Does anybody have a thought on that? But just in the language of the Tosefta. So in Halachi Yud Zayin, it's Lachbor Boro Shichin Ma'aros, Lachbor Imahen. We'll attack in a samik vos amas amayim, and then in halachi yed ches, lasos lechi v'kor lamavoi, lasos benem charetz ben charetz. My brother-in-law lives in St. Louis. Sent out a picture on the family WhatsApp of him hammering in some boards to fix the St. Louis Erev. He's like, yeah, everyone's got to chip in to fix this Erev that fell down a month ago. So, in these examples, it's not clear that it's limited to financial contribution. It might be that you have a physical physical obligation to chip in. Is that your sense from reading these? What do you guys think when you read this? Lasos benam. Rami?
I mean, I assumed it was paying. But you see in the Rabbanan, in both Sukhna Kyut, the Gemara, that there is some conversation about...
Yeah, later on.
They have to actually, even if they have to pay, they might have to actually do the work.
Yeah. So what do you think from the language?
I assumed
it was just payment.
My gut is to assume that things are payment unless it specifies otherwise.
Okay.
And I didn't think this clearly did.
Even though it's lach bori mahen.
Yeah, that just means like I read that as like if the city's doing this project.
You got to chip in.
Yeah.
I think the language of the Tosefta could be both.
Right.
In political philosophy, people who are upset about taxation say taxing earnings is the equivalent of forced labor. So if the state can't require us to do forced labor for it, it can't require us to chip in. So it's a reductio ad absurdum argument, right? Here, though, it seems to be an Enochanami conclusion, right? In the same way that B'nai Ha'ir could be kofa on Kesef, they could also be kofa for physical labor if that's what the Tzarchei Ha'ir need. Like, Israel has a draft, right? If you can't hire people to do the army for you, then you could obligate people to chip in with their own person, their own body, for the public goods of the community. Net?
The person who would be required to do this could just hire someone else to do it.
If that's available, right, assuming that's a possibility. It might be reasons why you can't just hire somebody else. The tight labor market, or for security reasons you can, right? Yeah? Josh?
Can you explain that philosophical point again? Why is taxing earnings specifically like forced labor?
Why is it forced labor?
Like, why that over like any tax that would take money out of your pocket?
Yeah, I mean, just earnings is usually the...
Okay. Yeah,
but the thought is that because then you have to work more to generate that same type of income. So it's an equivalent to forcing you to work. That's the argument. But it's not clear to me in these Toseftas and these halachos that there's a presumption in halacha against requiring you to work on behalf of the B'nai Ha'ir if it's to create those public goods. Benji?
Like in America, in terms of like contract enforcement, if you have like a contract with a plumber,
yeah,
and they don't show up,
it's just financial,
then you can't force them to come in.
Yeah, there's a very strong presumption against specific performance. It's just financial.
It's always compensation, like financial compensation.
Can I open this window? Yeah. Anybody else boiling hot?
Yes, I would love you.
Turn it off. Man, it gets too cold, no? Yeah. Okay, so you guys with me on this reading that maybe it's even forced labor? Tsarya, you with me on this reading? Well, yes, it certainly seems possible. Actually, I see no reason to limit it. Remember, this example, the first example is specific performance, right? That you could be kofa, shelo lohoshiv beinehem, lo chayit, lo borsiv, lo. So there you're actually not allowing certain things to take place. We'll see some cases of performance also. I don't know if anybody read the Mordechai citing the Maram about leaving town if there's no minion. Right? That's also a compelling performance. Anybody catch that?
Well, but again, it's not really. It's only in the sense that I think the option is also hire somebody else. So we haven't really...
Right, if that's an option. Right, assuming that's a possibility.
Right.
But if it's not a possibility, at least there's a right to compel activities, actions.
Well, yeah, or a right to... You can force them to not leave. Yeah, right, I guess.
Right, which seems to be you're canceling everyone's yontif plans, right, just because you can't get a minion. Okay, then they had Tosefta a few halachas later. Yud Aleph Chav Gimel. Josh, continue. Kofim b'nei Ayir.
Kofim b'nei Ayir says, Liv Noslahen Yisak Nasas, but Liv Noslahen Sefer Torah. So you could, the people of the city need to chip in for shul and for Sefer Torah.
Yeah, you could see Josh threw in a sneaky word there. He said chip in. That usually connotes financial chipping in. Maybe Liv knows. Josh doesn't want to stand there putting bricks on the Beis HaKnesses. It's not clear, right? Liv knows could mean to build physically. Liknos. What?
That's true.
Well, Liknos is to acquire. So, you know, there it seems maybe more just financial. Okay, so the Tosefta's examples are actually, in my opinion, pretty broad. You guys agree? Okay. Now the Shulchan Aruch adopts some of these in Siman Kuf Samech Gimel. So the Rama writes, he extends this to paying for a chazin, he extends this to paying for teachers in a community. What does he write? Ned, you want to read it for us? B'makom Shabnei Ayir. So what's going on there?
So the parents can't afford to pay for a teacher for kids, and so the community gets together and they have to pay for it together.
Exactly. And it seems like you could impose this tax on the community to pay for the Schiras Malamdin.
Yeah.
So we'll look at Lefi Mamon. That's our next sugya about how to distribute it. Right here, we're just interested in pinning down the scope of the communal powers. Lefi Mamon, we'll figure out. We'll have to look at the Yad Ramah's Kuntres. Anybody see the Yad Ramah's Kuntres? He has like 20 pages working out that sugya. Right, seemed a little excessive to me, but we'll look at it carefully. Then he quotes this line in the Tosefta, which we read. Go ahead, Ned. That's a building of Beis HaKnesses. And then he adds the broadest generalization, which he gets from the Chuv of the Marimins, which we'll look at. Afal Pi. Yeah, so here there are two things that are interesting in this line of the Ramah. So number one, is out there the extension to cold Sarkaya year. Did everybody catch that? The Ramah in Siman Kuf Samech Gimel says that this power applies to cold Sarkaya year. So I'll say that's the broadest formulation we've seen yet. He gives some examples, which we'll get to. But then there's a second point. Afal Pisha Mikzasan Einan Srichin. This came up in the last year. Who gave the example? Benji, was it you with the guy sleeping with the revolver under his pillow?
Okay.
Josh, you gave that example?
Yeah.
Right, so it's Sarkaya, but even if some people in the community don't need it, okay? Afal Pisha Mikzasan Einan Srichin. Now that's the really interesting principle, because why should the people who don't need it be compelled to pitch in? This is, of course, where people take umbrage. They get offended at having to chip in for these things, right? That's why Zolti didn't want to pay for the public schools, right? He doesn't need them, right? I'm not missing the main points. We covered that in the last year. We don't have to do Chazarish here on it again yet until it's relevant. So this is a really interesting thing. And what does he give as examples? A base chasnas and a mikvah. So I guess not everyone needs the mikvah, certainly not the older people. Maybe a base chasnas, your kids already married off, you don't have kids, whatever it is. Nevertheless, you have to chip in. So what explains that power? And why should you have to chip in there? So I want to see if we could get a sense of, to answer this question at some point. Because that's really the interesting question. Right, so you're forced to pay a cost that you don't really need. So this is really I'm going to put a star here. We want to keep our eyes open for answers to this. Like somebody trying to explain why the mikzah san she'enam tzrichin have to pay. We covered something in the last year that might help explain that. The idea that maybe you of course receive some tangential benefit or some derivative benefit from other people having these goods. That's one possibility. But we should keep our eyes open for others. So the public utilities thing, you could say, well, everybody needs water, everybody needs sewage. These are a little trickier because you could be co-found them even when yechidim don't benefit. Okay. The Gra here in Simkuf Samach Gimel makes a few points. He just emphasizes the fact that this power applies to Kol Tzarchei Ha'ir. He says this is grounded in the Tosefta as the makar for the Shulchan Aruch. That's all straightforward. And then the Sma tries to qualify the broad sweep of the Ramah's principle. So who got a chance to look at the Sma in this formulation? Volunteers, Chari, you want to tell us?
Do you want me to go back to the Grabo?
Sure.
So he highlighted the last line of Tol Tzarchei Ha'ir, which has to justify it in Tosefta. I think the point he's trying to justify is the Mikzasan Einan Tzrichin point. He reads the Tosefta as Alpisha Eino Shosan, that even though you don't need that water, and presumably you're not getting any enough from it, that's the proof that you have to contribute to these things.
Yeah. So if in the cases of the Tosefta, that if you're out of town, you have to pay for the water things.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that this is distinct, different from the Yadarma.
The Yadarma.
That it actually was kind of benefit. A benefit that made this property rentable.
Yeah. I think that's a really great point.
Like
so
we're hanging so much on like a Dia in a Tosefta that is not really.
Mukhrech. Yeah. So Zachariah is saying the Yadarma gave us a reason why I have to pay for my Hamptons house, why for the taxes. Because I could rent it out, right? So I gained from the benefit of the Hamptons, even though I'm not living there, because I could rent it out. And Asiba said, oh, because I have stuff stored in my house there in the Hamptons, right? So I have to pay for the security, etc. That was the Nasivas' argument. And the Gra actually reads the Tosefta differently and says that Tosefta is a makor for even when you're not benefiting, you have a duty to pay. Yeah, great points, Tarya. Ned?
Going back to the Yadarma for a second.
The Yadarma from yesterday? From last week?
The
Yadarma. Oh, the Rama, okay.
Yeah. He's saying that there's one individual who can't pay, or there are many individuals who can't pay?
This phrase.
Yeah.
It sounds Lashon Yachid, right?
Yeah.
Avihen shel tinokos yachol liskor libnehem. But Livnehem is plural.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
I don't think it really matters, because even if, what if it's multiple parents who can't pay? Like, why does it matter whether it's a single parent or multiple parents?
Maybe if it's multiple, then the broader community doesn't have resources, and then maybe there'd be some other way.
I think what's significant for the Ramah's point is that as long as there are some people who can't pay, the community bears the burden. That's how I read it. Good. So let's come back to the Sma. How does the Sma limit Shulchan Aruch and Kuf Samech Gimel? The Shulchan Aruch said Kol Tzarchei Ha'ir. What does the Sma do here? Ariel?
saying even if it's there are people who don't need it, if it's something that the majority or a significant portion of would need, they're going to be paying for it as well.
So what's he distinguishing between? He's distinguishing between two types of public goods. Anybody want to... Ariel?
To read it?
Why don't you read it and tell me what he's distinguishing between.
Near Dafkakol, Kohanei, Bechoy Yisrael, Tzvikim, Levesh, Kosmos, Omikvah, Af, Yimilua, Sheyachid, Enot, Sarek, Lo, Mohammed, Zekina, O, Eilutah, even if there's some situation where somebody may not need it, Af, Yilaf, Eit, Sarek, Eit, 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 Eit,
Yes, what's he saying? What's considered a basic good that you can be kofa on?
It's a public good, even if you personally might not need it. The item which you're paying for is not something that somebody's going to use on an individual level, rather it's something which is a public space.
He's trying to say there are some things that are just characterized as kol yisrael tzrichim. Right? So there's some things that everybody needs. Even if, for whatever reason, your situation is exceptional such that you won't need it. Somebody see that? So the thought is, let's say, everybody is going to need income when they're old and retired. It may be the case that you were successful enough when you were younger that your particular situation means you don't require it. Does that make sense? But that's something that's kol yisrael tzrichim. So it's a genuine public good in that the entire public requires it. But that's consistent with a few individuals not requiring it. So you might say education, maybe. Everybody requires education and healthcare, even if there are a few people who never go to the doctor their whole life. Let's do the healthcare example, right? Everybody needs healthcare, even if you're going to be perfectly healthy and never end up at the doctor. Because that's something that's a freak fact about your specific condition. Does everybody see that? Yes? Whereas, Masha'in Kain, Kishehotziu Hotsa, Sheyazer Lehem Asar, Binyan Shtarchov, She'eno Inyan Klali. Let's say the community had to pay off some official to help them enforce a debt. That's not a genuine public good that everybody really requires. So it's a communal need, but it's something that's unique to the facts of, I guess, this community or something. Everybody see that? So he wants to distinguish between something that's universal in application versus something that is not universal, although it's not really clear how this paying off this sar to enforce, what type of thing that is. But he does want to limit the things upon which a community could be co-found to the class satisfied by kol yisrael tzrichim. Josh?
For about the first point, do you think he's saying that, like, because it's a universal need, even though you don't need it, like, we don't care, we make it care for the universal need? Or do you think he's saying that, like, kind of like a butt of the road type thing, like, the universal need, like, defines it, like, just like pork, like, and a mixture of, like, kosher food would, like, become kosher? I don't know if that's a good example or not.
Okay.
Do you think he's saying, like, a universal need, like, defines you as you're part of the mixture, like, you need it too?
Yeah, it's hard to know what the underlying rationale is. He doesn't give us. Correct. He doesn't explain it. In political philosophy, sometimes what you get is an argument that, well, this is something that you might end up needing. So it's rational for you, meaning it's fair for the community to charge you because you might end up needing it, even though as a freak of nature, it turns out that you didn't need it. Right. So the idea is that a homeless shelter or something, right? I guess maybe something like that, anybody could end up there. So it's reasonable for you to... I don't know if you say it's kol yisrael tzrichim, but a basic nesas, right? Even if it turns out that you always daven biyachidus, you're still tzarech to a basic nesas. It could be something like that, but it's not clear. He doesn't tell us. Okay. Everyone good so far? Okay. Romy.
We don't know what that's grounded in.
This limitation. Right. We don't know. We want to keep our eyes open, so I'm going to put another star here as to why he limits it. And Josh, all of Josh's points are possibilities, but I want to flag it here. Because you could have said, no, the power of the B'nai Yair is unchecked. But if they want to tax, they could tax for anything. And he's limiting it to, like, genuine public goods. See that?
Well, I would ask another direction. Why are you allowed to include these people who don't benefit? Just because it's both
our aid. Yeah, good. So let me say a little more then. So Romy's point, can you guys see this or you can't? This is all is obscured by the screen. It's obscured by the screen.
I'll just go this way.
Romy's point is, I take it, that this can't really be about Hanah. Right? If this is a Yoreh type principle, as we spoke about in the very opening of the Sugya, this still allows you to tax individuals who are not benefiting. Right? So we're moving away from specific Yoreh and Hanah-based justification for the tax. Correct? Daniel, you agree with that? Good. Okay. Let's see if the Pesachei Tshuva sheds light on anything. Kasamach Gimel Chaf Gimel, what does he say? Anybody want to read this Pesachei Tshuva, another qualification, Ned? Louder, louder. Yeah, so what's he saying?
It's something that the inheritor does not acquire, so then so the rogue is not obligated to pay for it.
Yeah. Do you like this idea? That if it's something that the rogue doesn't need, then they're not obligated to chip in. Yeah, that's one way to go. That it's almost like a semantic point.
Yeah.
A public good is defined by those things that the public needs. And a majority of people don't need it, then it's not a public good.
And Shmuel? It also depends how you define need. Like, need,
yeah.
Now, potentially need.
Right, wants, needs, right. Ought to need, ought to have. Yeah, this tsrichenlo is a very important phrase that doesn't get fleshed out. And then he points us to the Mari Mintz, which we're going to look at. Shekasav shekol davar. Go ahead, Ned. Yeah, those are the things that you could be kofa on. Right, but that does that phrase substantiate?
It's not a need, it's something that's just sort of positive.
Yeah, notice that statement itself distinguishes between toeles tikun kahal. Those are two separate possibilities. Toeles akal, tikun akal, as distinct from the third disjunct, lerov akal, right? So you might think that there are things which are the toeles akal, even if they're not things that rov akal require. Can anybody think of examples of that? So let's say a mikvah. Let's say a mikvah, and you only have a small constituency that's young enough to require a mikvah. So you might say, well, that's still letikon hakal or toelas hakal, even if rov hakal doesn't require it. That might be one type of thing. Education, milam de tinokos. Let's say there's only a few young people in town with kids. Maybe that's still a toelas hakal, even if it's not letzorech rov hakal. Romy, is that what you're going
to
say?
Well, I was going to say this seems to be like the opposite sheet of the Neri that we saw last year. That suggests that it's not about stuff and not about the rope. So this highlights that it actually might be just about the rope.
Yeah.
The last time complicated a little bit, but the beginning, Shimudavar Sharov and the Srizin, right, just about the rope.
Right, we saw in the Miri in the last year that a Yachid could compel the Rabbin.
So this seems to be the opposite.
Yeah. So let's go. So you guys hear what Rumi's saying? The whole point of the Pesachei Tshuva is to qualify this by the needs of the rov. So that's the Pesachei Tshuva. Romy is saying, how does this square with what we saw in the Ramah and in the Meiri last year, who all said, Afilu miyut kofen b'neir zezeh, Afilu miyut kofen asamarubin. And the Meiri's language of Af Echad Mehen Kofe Eschaverov, Eschaverov Bekach. Right? So That's a really good point. And I want to say the deeper philosophical issue here that turns on that question is whether, are these principles of just majoritarian rule that we thought, like, the majority has a coercive power against the yuppie? That's just brute majoritarianism. Or are these principles grounded in something different? If you go for the Ramah and the Meiri's view that the miyud could be kofa the rabim, it's clearly not a majoritarian perspective. It has to do something about every community has to supply public goods by hook or by crook. And every individual in those communities has a right to those public goods and a coercive power against the rabim to get them. Which is closer to what we would say in contemporary parlance, that these are rights that the individuals have. And they could enforce those rights against the rabim. That's very different than something that says, oh, the rabim of any community gets to speak on behalf of the community for what's good for it. Yes? We had a hand up, Scarlett?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out this distinction between the Meyer Mintz's formulation of Ho'alas HaKamal versus the Tshuva is, he says it's just a kind of rove, a rove HaKamal. I know when I read that into his Tshuva and the Smut, is that this kind of knocking of, let's say, you have something which is, you know, general communal need, but just practically in this circumstance, a majority don't need it.
Yeah.
Like examples you gave would be like really strong.
Yes, 1,000%. 1,000%. So we need to try to nail this down a little more, look for some formulations in the Rishonim, and we're gonna, as we get deeper into the Chuvas of the Maharam Nirenberg, and then we'll see some Chuvas of Rashba along those lines, we wanna build up these questions. Romy and then Ned.
Just a quick technical thing. When you say, oh, how does that fit with the Ramah, is that, like, does the big picture
have
half the...
No. Okay. Yeah, I meant in your way, just conceptually speaking, what different views are they endorsing? Yeah. Ned.
So, when we say we have, like, a partnership, some sort of needs...
Just talk louder so I can hear you.
We're talking about certain needs, like, things
that have the... Toelas, tikkun, tzrichin...
What if there are other ways of making, let's say, certain individuals or majority already have a way of getting it without funds and clearing it?
If they have ways?
If the community already has something, would this necessitate restructuring the entire system such that there'd be a new financing system that's based off of this communal contribution?
So that's a little abstract for me. Say it again.
You have some sort of need, public need, that currently is being taken care of by the private sector, or the private individual pay for it.
Yeah.
So would this require an entire upheaval of that system?
Meaning, is it okay that it's taken care of by the private sector?
Yes.
Yeah. So everybody see Ned's question? Give us an example, Ned.
Healthcare.
Yeah.
Healthcare.
Flesh it out for us.
So, currently people pay for healthcare at an active employer or whatever, and the question is whether or not this would necessitate, is there some sort of value in having a community pay for it?
Right. Does the DAFKA have to be publicly funded,
yeah,
as you're asking? So yeah, I would argue, and then let's say if there is a private provision.
It's no longer there, right?
Yeah, right. I think that would be the way to go. The way to go would be say, if there's a system in place such that the needs are adequately met, then it's not really tzorech hakol because it's satisfied as is. But Daniel doesn't like that.
No, I mean, like, I say you already have a family donated mikvah in town. Like, it's very, very good. Like, you're going to start forcing everyone to now fund a new mikvah.
Right, you're saying for sure not.
For sure not. No,
right. Like, same with schools, right? So if you have private schools, let's say, and assuming that those are already working for everybody, then maybe you can't impose a tax on everybody to support the schools or publicly finance it.
But then it becomes problematic because once you remove the definition of whatever, then the minority can't afford it. It's no longer that definition. It's no longer definition of Darasara.
Yeah.
You can't.
So maybe it would depend on these Rishonim, on these discussions, whether it's Dafka Sheh Rabim Tzrichim Lahem, or even if the Miyad is Tzarech Lahem, could they be Kofa the Rabim? Right? So everybody see that? Next point is, let's say you have a private school system, and then that works for majority of the community, but not for the people who require scholarships, let's say. So could you be kofa everybody to chip in? So that my answer is that might depend on whether you could be kofa for the miyut also. So for the miyut, either a ma for sure, right? Now, I think the more interesting question, Ned, not that yours isn't interesting, but the more interesting variation on your point is, so what do you kofa the rabbim on in that case? Everybody see the case? The case is majority of the community is paying out of their tuition to send their kids to MTA. Okay? Miyut of the community can't afford that. So there's an interesting question, is that sarche a year now? And that depends, does that mean sarche rova year, or are there certain things that objectively are considered sarche a year, either under the smas theory that kol Yisrael tzrich in education, or under the miyuri ramos theory that even the miyuts needs, if they're necessary needs, could compel other people to chip in. So what is it that we're co-found in that case, assuming we're co-found? Ned, what would you say you're co-found?
The common range of the costs for the individual.
Oh, okay. So we're on the same page. Meaning what you would be co-found in that case is just to have the public finance the...
A scholarship fund.
Right, a scholarship fund within the privately existing institution as it is. Right? Not to say that now, because there's a miyut that's sorry, we have to have a publicly financed educational system.
Yeah,
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Seeing that you're not going to hire a teacher. They're already motivated to say.
Yeah, all right. So you just get the public to chip in for the deficit. Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. Because the tzorech is defined by the deficit. Not that now there's a tzorech, so they're going to be kofa on a whole new educational system. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Josh?
But, I mean, is this a case where there's already a public school in town? Because then you could say that Sorok is also already taken care of. So why should you have to pay for him to come to the private school?
So it depends what you think about, what type of Jewish education a person should have.
Right.
So some people feel very strongly that public school education is not adequate. Ezra maybe is going to defend the other view. I think we had this exchange, right, Ezra?
What's considered a tzorech.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's, a lot of this depends on what's considered a tzorech, tzorech harabim. So, good. Very good discussion here. So let's look now at the Mari Mintz. Mari Mintz was considered to be one of the major postgame for late medieval Ashkenaz. 15th century. So do you guys know a little Ashkenazic Jewish history? It's always good to look up the Rishonim, so... What? What? Right. So if you think about Ashkenaz, you have early Ashkenaz, like before the Crusades, before the 11th century. That's Rabbeinu Gershom, and like Rabbeinu Gershom's Talmidim. You have Rashi around then. And then you have another Tekufa in the 12th century of Rabbeinu Tam, the Baal HaTosfos. And you get the 13th century and the 14th century is just Talmidim of the Baal HaTosfos, like the Rosh Mishans, the Ritzbah. These names sound familiar? The Re, the Re Mir Orleans. And then that's it for France. And in Germany, you get the, in the 12th century, you get the Ravia, the Ravan, these names. These are like the German Baal HaTosfos. And then the Or Zeruah. And then after that, you get the Marami Rutenberg. Marami Rutenberg lived in the 13th century. He was put in jail till the end of the 13th century. He had two big Talmidim. Who were his Talmidim?
The Rosh Mordechai.
Yeah, the Rosh and the Mordechai. Yeah, the Rosh and the Mordechai are his two. Also, the Hagos Maimonios are considered Talmidim of the Maram. And then that's basically it. That's the end of Ashkenaz, really. You get the Tumas Hadeshin a little later, but that's it. Then you get the Black Plague, which killed off most of the Jewish community. Jews are expelled from France and Germany, so they start migrating east. And Mari Mintz is one of the Rishonim of that later Tzkufa, meaning after the 14th century. So you can see here, I gave you his bio. He is... 15th to 16th century. And he leaves Germany and ends up in Italy. There's this whole migration east. So he's one of the big poskim of this tekufa. You get the Mari Mintz in this era, anybody know what other Ashkenazic Rishonim we have here?
Maybe the Ron?
Ron Svardik.
Torna.
He's Svardi. The tour ends up in Spain, but he's a son of the Rush, right? He's in Spain. Who else? The name is Mari Bruna. Sound familiar? No? Mari Weil? No? But those are the colleagues of the Mariments. You guys got to learn your Jewish history. It's necessary to just get a sense of like who, like, even the fact that he says we have to Paskin, now he's like the Maram. No, so you got to figure out. You see, like, the Maram loomed pretty large over these later Ashkenazim. But always lift up the Rishonim before you read them. So let's talk about this tshuva. What's going on here? What were the questions sent to the Marimins? Tzacharya?
Yeah, so...
Next Bechina is going to include the bios of the Rishonim.
It's actually pretty tragic that this is like, we only have 16 tshuvas left, like everything else was burnt.
Yeah, you saw that in the
yeah,
bio.
Yeah.
They lived really awful lives. I mean, that the 15th, 16th century in Ashkenaz, the people live.
I mean,
he lived pretty long. People had very short lives. It was horrible. The Black Plague was killing everyone. You can see here from this tshuva itself how any time it was a non-Jewish holiday, the Jews were in Sakana. Did you guys catch that?
They didn't go to the river.
Right, that was the dispute, whether the mirror, this is like the question about public school, right? Was the river enough of a mikvah? So the fear was that they were persecuted by the non-Jews whenever they would go to the river for the mikvah when it was near the non-Jewish holidays. That didn't strike anybody? Did anybody catch that in the tshuva? No? Really? Raise your hand if you caught that part of the tshuva. Just Zacharya?
Also, he signs himself like
Anochi Akatan.
Like, that's his.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that they...
It's not.
Yeah, people point out also that these tshuvas of this generation, there's a real sense of inferiority compared to the earlier generations. You know, Odiachem Daiti Aklusha. And I'll give you my weak position. It was like this sense of like there were these Gedolim and Ashkenaz, and then there were these later postgame who didn't feel like they were on the same level as the earlier ones.
So he was asked three questions.
Yeah, so what are the three questions?
So I'll relate to that community. So community was building a new shul, and they appoint people to take charge of the construction project, and they're being a little too fancy or too expensive than some people wanted, and they're asked to chip in, and they didn't want to because they said, hey, this is too expensive.
Yeah, so you live in a community. In this community, it happened that there were some people in charge of designing the new shul. I guess the construction got out of hand, and then people are going to be disgruntled. Why do you spend so much money on the shul? Right? We could have done it for less. We would have gotten a different contractor. That sound familiar to any of you? When I started at Englewood, that was like all the... Everyone was up in arms about how much money they spent on the new shul. Yeah, that was like the big hawk in town. So that's similar to what happened, I guess, several hundred years earlier. Okay, so the question is, does the Miyot have a right to not chip in? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the second question is, paying for the construction of a mikvah. Some people are claiming that they don't need it because they're already older, so therefore they shouldn't have to contribute.
Yeah. You can see also...
Yeah.
They wanted to build a mikvah bein ha-Yehudim b'makam tzanua. They wanted to build a mikvah within the Jewish community in a private place so that a woman could go to the mikvah. Bilti ema v'yir of a fachad lo b'halicha v'lo b'chazir lo me'arelim v'lo me'pritzim, because it was considered dangerous. Like, you'd go, I guess they'd go out to this river or something to the mikvah, and there were these robbers and bandits and people harassing them. So the question is, is that a tzorah? Could the community finance mikvah? And some people resisted. You said, why? Right, so they're saying, we don't benefit from this. Why should we have to chip in? And what's the third issue?
The third one was also very interesting. They had some sort of Knesset Orphan lottery when Norek would come to town. They had a lottery that run in the town to kind of pick up. And the Gabbai would kind of like pick out a name and say, okay, you go responsible for taking care of this guest who came to town. And so people wanted to change the policy so that the the Oreff himself would have to pick out the little lottery ticket so that he could be embarrassed that he wouldn't want to come back.
Yeah, and not exactly, and that was the intent, right?
Yeah.
So there was the Zachnas Zorchim thing that the community, I guess, used to do it in a way that was very dignified. They would, I guess, designate somebody who would take care of the Ani, but they wanted to reverse it so that it'll be intentionally embarrassing for the Ani to have to reveal himself. And then this way, the community would end up having to spend less on Achnas Sorchim because it would deter Aniim from coming to town.
Sounds a lot like
Morrison
Hedrum.
What?
Sounds a lot like
Morrison
Hedrum, so.
Yeah, I've had Midas Stone. Right. Yeah. So you could see, they wanted to Kidei Sheyizbaye Sha'ani Velo Yosef Lavo, Ode. Right, they wanted to change it into a demeaning way. And if you saw the end of the Tshuva, the Mari Bruna rips on them for this, right? He had such a great phrase. I'll just highlight it here. He, katzti b'chayai. Right, exactly. Lahazkir l'sasek in this question. And v'hamis nagdim omrim. So this is a great, also a little verbal spat between the groups. What did the Misnagdim say? Right. Kind of strange, like, to imagine that. Like, were they actually the people who were trying to deter people who didn't want the Aniim? Right. Well, is the argument against them that you're not being Mekayim Achnas Azorchem, you're being Mekayim Hotzah Azorchem? Just like that should win them over. Yes, it's called Hotzah Azorchem, and the question was, who's in the right? That's not really so much of a Kofin B'nai Eir's that was an issue, although it is about who gets to make decisions for the town because people are of different minds. So all these cases are about what happens when what? How do you guys characterize the common theme to all of these questions? Eitan? Northman?
Not sure?
Daniel?
We want to tell something that minority is against.
Yeah. It's all just a collective action problem, right? Who gets to make these decisions for the community? And what rights does the rope have, the mute have? It's exactly that. Who gets to speak and decide for the community? So he begins his analysis by pointing us to the tshuva of the Maharami Rotenberg. Just to give you a sense, you could see how the high esteem which he holds the Maharami Rotenberg in. He says, I'm going to cite Tshuvas Maharam Asher Rov Min Hagenu Uveprat Min Haga Ashkenazim Lelech Achar Daito. Since you can see here already, he's saying that the Maharami Rotenberg was authoritative and that they followed him. This is like the theory for a Hilchasa Kibasroya, you follow the last posik, because he assimilated the earlier poskim and then made a decision having considered their judgment. Yes? Okay. So he starts off citing the tshuva of the Maharam. Let's look at the tshuva of the Maharam inside, and then we'll just come back to his analysis of it. So we're going to look at the tshuva Simonios in Seder Kinyan, Simon Chav Zayin. Zachar, you want to take us through the tshuva of Maharam?
Sure. Inside or?
Inside.
Yeah. Al Shere Sha'amta Lufeg Yodai Harav Rav'ava Levi In Yish Katza Bein Halfem Beinam Nichol Mahashlos Daitam Lavar Roshim Haskamas Kulam. So you can't take heads of the community. Zeh Morbaka Ko Zeh Morbaka Umach Maschilot Liban Abito Hatamid Minas Hadin Minas Hidaloka Bein Amas Mishpat Shalom Beir Velo Bechol Amalfos Hanengrarim Akarehem Eichyas. So they can't take communal leaders. What do you do?
And it sounds like it was just a mess, right? They couldn't do anything in town. I guess that's what it means, like, batel hatamid. I guess there's no shul. And midas adin loka. And nobody could enforce any policies because it's the Wild West. Nobody could impose order on anybody else.
So,
right?
So you collect all the tax-paying members of the community. And they accept upon themselves other mentor that's meant. Kapolei Bracha, is this like a euphemism for like an Allah?
Yeah, I think so.
Alright.
Yeah, like they all swear basically that they would say they would speak L'Shem Shemayim, you know, give their honest opinion.
Alright. Shkolecha Yomar Daito Shem Shemayim Tukanas Ha'ir Yuflach Aruf Heim Livur HaRoshim Heim Ma'amim Chazanim Heim Atakim Kishol Tzedakah Heim Limnos Gabayim in Libnos, in Listor, the base Akneses, Lahosiv, Libroa, Lignos, base Asnos, Libnos, Listorbo, Lignos, base Ophim, Libnos, Listorbo, Sotavar, Kol, Sarfe, Hakal, Yasa, Alpiem, Asher, Jumra. So,
yeah.
Follow the road for all these decisions.
Yeah, so everyone's going to get up there. Everyone's going to express their opinion. And then we'll just follow the road for all these social issues, whether it's the bakery, whether it's the Beis HaKnesses, whether it's the Melos HaTzedaka, the Chazanim. The majority gets to rule. And that's like a very clear articulation of this principle. Kofin B'nai Yerza, he doesn't cite that yet, but the majority gets to decide. What happens if the minority dissents?
So the majority or the one appointed by the majority has the power to enforce.
Yeah. So the majority has the power to coercively impose their will on the minority. It's a very famous Chu of the Marami Rutenberg. And the miyot has to chip in also financially. Okay.
So if someone chooses not to vote, he wants to vote.
So you can't defeat the jurisdiction of the rove by not voting. Even if you don't vote, you're subject to the majority's decision. Okay, now here's the important part for us.
So anything that they need a lot.
Okay, so stop here. So you get this very wide-ranging legal ruling of the Maram of Rutenberg, according these very strong powers to the Kahal. They could impose their will on the minority. They could force all these building projects. The miyot has to pitch in. And what's his source? What is he grounded in?
Tosefta.
Yeah, he grounds it in this Tosefta, which is what our Gemara is based in, grounded in, Kofen B'nai Yer Zezeh, Libnos Lem Beis HaKnesses, etc. That's the halachic source that tells you that the Kahal has this type of authority. Okay? And then he goes a little further. How does he go further, Zechariah?
So he says, for the Lefi and Korah, so you can force from that, Apopisha Ainza Tarfadol Koka, Philhaki Kofin, Kolshkin Shar and Yanim, Hatzrikha, Lahem Yosef, Hayazah Shalom, Ani, Meir, Rinbok. So he's saying, from the fact that the Tosefta brings the Lefi and Korah case, which is not an important need, we can deduce that you can enforce for any more important need.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the conclusion of the Marami Rutenberg. Does that sound like a reasonable conclusion from our Tosefta? Yeah, good. You see how it's a much broader, more powerful articulation of it. But he says he's just getting this from the Tosefta. He's just applying the Tosefta's rule in a straightforward way. What problem is the Maram addressing explicitly that's not addressed in the Tosefta? I mean, I see the Maram here is doing two things.
So, if you look at the Tosefta and the Gemara that we read versus the Tshuva, the Maram, and the Tshuva Samonios, what are the two things the Maram does beyond the Tosefta itself? Why is Maram significant?
Josh?
He's more explicit about the majority part.
No. Okay, good. What do you mean he's more explicit about the majority part?
The Tosefta didn't even really mention that at all.
Exactly. The Tosefta itself did not take a stance on how you're kofa, or how you figure out what the ratzon of the kahal is. The Maram gave us a procedure for how this power could be implemented. You get everyone together, you figure out what the das harov is, and that's how you could enforce it. Well,
sounds very Athenian.
Everyone gets together, voices their opinion. Yeah, direct democracy. Yeah. You'll see that some Rishonim actually talk about what happens if you have people who are appointed by that Tzibor. So that would take away the directness of it. But they think it has the same legal force. Right.
Okay, good. And the second part here is his that's a very important extension. So Sefta, he goes to the Lechi and the Korah example and says, oh, you see that the Kofin says that, even if it's not a Tzorah Gadol. So that's a very broad interpretation of the Kol's powers. Josh?
I don't really get the part, the Kofin Ashiyom who wrote some anathem. What exactly is that talking about?
You beat them up.
Like, yeah, that's what it sounds like, right?
You're saying, why does he require that they say Rotsa Manachnu?
Yeah, is that what he's implying? That we're going to like hit them until they say, like, why do we need them to like say we want it? Like, that's like a thing that I get, but I don't know what
that's
doing here.
Yeah. Well, till Yevazavin until she accepts or until he accepts. Except that over here, if you're compelling on specific performance, so it's very hard to actually drag people to do something that they don't want to do.
So
you have to beat them into being willing to do it.
That seems...
I mean, I don't think he's saying that for this to have legal effect, you need the Mio to eventually sign on to it. I don't think he's saying that. I think he's just saying practically to enforce this, you know, you need to twist some arms until they're willing to act on it. That's how I read it. Great. Let's go to the Maram Mari Bruna, Sir Buddha of Bruna. So he cites this tshuva of the Maharami Rotenberg. So, Ad Kan Lashono. And what does he say? He says we're bound by the tshuva of the Maharam. And what does he say? He emphasizes the Kol Tzorche Ha'ir. Kol Shekein Sharen Yonim Hatzrichem Lahem Yoser. So he teases out many of these themes in the Tshuva of Maharami Rotenberg. And then he points us to a Mordechai. So the Mordechai is also citing who? Maharami Rotenberg. So you see the Maharami Rotenberg did a lot of work fleshing out the powers of the B'nai Ha'ir. So we're going to see a few more Tshuvas of his. That this extends to which area of Halacha? So Zecharia, take us through this quickly. Yeah. So we get this extension of this principle both to Hachnasas Orchim and Staka. The community has the power to force each other to chip in. Let's think about that for a second. What does that mean? Compelling people to chip in for Hachnasas Orchim? What type of coercion would that be?
What?
Tzedakah. So tzedakah is one of them.
Or could be like physically like offering up beds and stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's like, what is it, the Fourth Amendment? About quartering soldiers. Yeah. Please, you know, you force somebody to put up guests for Shabbos. That might be more than just kfiyah b'mamon. So it's one of the things we wanted to keep our eyes open for. So he cites the Mordechai and Parakama about Basra. I think I put that Mordechai on here. Let me just check. Here's the Mordechai. Taf Samech Dalid. Pasak Rabbeinu Meir, also coming off the Tosefta of compelling people to write a Sefer Tonavim and Ksuvim. So what do we get here, Zechariah? Just read this. Pasak Rabbeinu Meir. Yes, there it sounds financial, right?
Well, yeah, that's a higher.
Ah. Just for the minion part.
Yeah.
Okay. What about this part? This is the part about forcing people to stay for minion.
Yeah.
So let's read this Zechariah and the Mordechai.
So, Mira Vadai im Imahim Minyan, Ela Im Shimon, Kofinoso, Oli Sha'er, Ola Haskir, Acher, Rim Komo. So if 10 people and Shimon wants to leave, so you either force him to stay or he has to hire someone to come to his place.
Yeah. And what does he cite?
Besides the
Tosefta.
Yeah.
The same Tosefta. So like all these dinim are being grounded in our Tosefta. Right? So what do you guys make of the fact that you could be kofes somebody to not leave town to ensure that you have a minion?
What do you make of that?
Pretty restrictive of his autonomy. He's still somewhere, I don't know.
Right. So the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. But isn't this a case of specific performance? Right? I mean, we're basically saying, I don't know, is that equivalent to the forced labor paradigm? We're basically saying you can't leave because we require you here. What do you guys think? I don't know.
I'm just thinking about when you stay with us for Shabbos Minyan Man.
What?
I'm just thinking about when you stay with us for Shabbos Minyan Man. Maybe they could have just forced them to stay for Shabbos.
Is that a song?
Yeah, you read that?
Yeah. No.
Schlager song?
As a Schlager rock? Nice. We could play it.
Sure.
Yeah. But there you go. I think that coercive power clearly speaks to the power of the call beyond just kfiyah b'mamon. Everybody, Ariel, do you agree with that?
I mean, I wonder if the idea of minyan is different to the minyan to be like a tzorach, almost like a mikvah in the community.
That's really important.
Yeah.
So you're very very high on minyanim. Is that what I'm understanding?
I wonder if it's something that like it's something you see as a value of a community, and therefore there's a different status there versus another scenario.
Yeah, possibly. But look at this. Then the Maharam himself makes this analogy. So Zachariah, take us to this analogy quickly.
Vidami
Amamish.
Hasam Mishaya Balam Rabin, Vasapal Rabin, Anathlam Rabin, the Ainsham Af there, Elabu, the Yeshasarega, Vati Sudaso, Yukholam Ma'akiv Al Yodo, Achi Yami Afair Tahta.
Yeah.
So someone who's like a barber or a baker for the community, and the time the rebel comes, he wants to
Head out early before people finish getting their haircuts for Yontif and before they got all their cakes for Yontif.
Uh-huh. So people can prevent him from leaving.
Yeah, the community has a right to say, like, do your job until everybody has their goods that they need for Yontif.
Right.
Right? So that also sounds like this is less, Ariel was saying maybe Minyan is special.
Yeah.
But now Ariel's going to say, well, what's Yontif without a haircut, and what's Yontif without your special challahs? Right, so you're going to say this is also like the mikvah and the basic nasas. How could you have Yontif without Ragalach? But here too, it sounds like you could compel him to stay. Right, so the points of these coercive powers seem very strong. Yeah.
Is there a sign to say that like before when we were saying like Sarkis Sorel, like could we be saying like maybe it's like religious, like what Ari is saying, like, these are like religious aspects that Yisrael means. It's like,
yeah, I guess so. But just for the haircut before Yontif, it's a little, it's hard to know what the underlying value of that is, right? Other than that there's, I guess, a communal interest. And yet the Tosefta here that the Mordechai appeals to, the Maharam Rumberg appeals to, says you can ma'akev on the person that he not be. And that's why, same principle for a minyan. Josh, you have a comment on this?
I feel like you could get pretty tricky with the numbers in terms of, let's say, all 10 of them don't really need the minion, but
yeah. How do you know which guy is the guy?
No. Let's say none of them really want the minion, but none of them can leave. So they all need to have.
They're forced.
Or like four of them want the minion, or six of them want the minion.
That's the Beit Rabin thing, right? So is it you need so, six people
or any people? Like it's
yeah, it's a really interesting point. See, so let's say only one person wants the minion,
right?
Right.
What if there's only a girl in town that wants the minion?
Could she be cool if had people to save the minion? Yeah, it's like the one Ovel. Right, like the one Ovel in town who wants to make sure that they can say Kaddish or answer Kaddish. But I think it's a really good point. That would depend on these questions about the Sma and the Pesachei Tshuva and the Miri, that whether the Miyot could be Kofa the Rabim. I hadn't thought of that. It's a really good point. Who gets to coerce on this? Anybody hear Josh's point? Yeah. Let me just make one other interesting observation here in the Mordechai. I know this is. This is a preview of something we're going to discuss later. Remember, in the last year, we discussed the how do you distribute the tax as separate from the question about the how much you could tax, etc. So, you already saw in your preparation the Gemara, there's Lefi Mamon, there's Lefi Nefashos, there's Lefi Kiruv Batim, right? Did anybody see the end of this, Mordechai? We're just trying to figure out, let's say two people want to leave town, right? And how does it work? Here. Yeah. Here. V'im yelech od echad min hakol v'lo yisharu el tisha. I think it sounds two people want to leave and it's not clear who's the 10th guy. Right? Maybe one's the 11th guy, one's the 10th guy. How do you know who the 10th guy is? So elu shnayim hayotzim yaskiru echad b'shutfus. So they both hire somebody. Bimkoman ze yitein chatzi yaskirus v'ze chatzi. So they want to leave. They want to hire somebody in their stead. Now look at this. So this is the distributional question. Somebody want to read this for me? Yeah. So how much do you charge?
The equal, they pay equally, even if one's rich. Why? And this phrase, comes from the mock this shekel, I think. Right? So it should be apportioned equally. Why? Because they each have an equal obligation to support the minyan. It's not that rich people are more obligated than poor people to support a communal minyan. Correct? So I think it's very interesting. This reminds me of the Adarma in Hezekriya Sugya, who said that's why the neighbors pitch in equally to the wall, even if one has a big lot and one has a small lot. Because they each have an equal obligation to remove Hezekriya, to not be mazik. So the moral obligation is the same, so they pitch in the same. We see that. So when the financial obligation stems not from what you're benefiting, but from like a duty to discharge some chiyuv, the chiyuv is the same between the two people. So we see that. That's gonna we're come back to this when we get to the distributional question. Somebody see that? How to distribute the tax? Thought on this? No. Josh, you like it?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty nice.
Rami, you have a thought on this?
Well, not on this particular line, but did the Mordechai ever say anything about a robe?
Here?
I don't think he's talking about a robe, needing a robe, just on the previous point.
Yeah, just that there. This goes to Josh's point, you're right. Saying.
I mean,
Josh
Hurt's point. I think that the question is, I don't think he assumes you need a robe to compel. I think you would go more in line. It sounds like you would go more in line with the Rama.
Even a yachid has this.
Right. I mean, otherwise, Josh's point is right. Once you only have 10 people, it's like. Pretty easily be not a rogue. I don't think that's what
you're talking about. Right. Unless there's a background assumption that the 9 people want their minion.
Right.
Right, which might be an underlying assumption. But we don't really know that. Mm-hmm. Good point. I wanted to make one other hara here. No, I'm not gonna make that hara now. So there are a few interesting points. This Mordechai, just bear in mind. I think the most important thing right now for us is his extension of the kfiyah powers, I think, explicitly to specific performance, to requiring you to stay, meaning if you can't be socher somebody else, then you're obligated to stay. So the powers here go beyond just the mere power to raise money. So it's more than our modern conception of raising taxes. Closer to the idea of imposing a draft. The community has this power. And that same concept might be applied to the Hachnasas Orchim. Pasak Rabbeinu Meir Dehu Adin Lahachnas Orchim, arguably that's to quarter guests, not just to pay for their food. Okay? Are you good? Okay, so let's go back to the Mari Bruna. So he's talking through all of these tshuvos. He said, Odis Sebe Mordechai, that's what we just read. He cited the Maram, Lachna Sorchim, etc. Hare Lefanenu. Here's how he summarizes these two tshuvos.
Sure. So, Hare Lefanenu, we call it now. The Kol Gavar Shem Toras, Otikum Akahal, O Lerov Akahal, Lomden, Midav Radom Elo, Acho Pishin, and Adol Mamish. Now, Kol Hani Shemuski, which was Maram, Orubam, Inam Suyam Lo Mishnah, Lo Brisa, Lo Tosefta, Lo Hiskubatamla. Al Yalak Lo Bidimayim, Mehaki to Kofabinet, Erzetsa, Lipnos Basic Messes, Yaporn and Dimu Suba. Mehaki to Bema, Boy Kobin Zad, Lassos Korbalaki. Afagah gained them in Mamish. So he says, we extrapolate the expanded scope.
Yeah, so you guys see this? He's like, look, I know the Gemara only gives you a very few cases. Right? Like Beis Shar and Delis. Like, but the Maram already went beyond that. He applied it to Tztakach, Nasas Orchim. Maram applied it to the Binyan Beis HaKnesses. So they go, once the Maram extends it, then you see that this Mishnah, this Brisa, contains much more. So I'm going to extend it also to apply to all of these types of cases. That's the move he makes. And again, we have this formulation that the Pesachei Tshuva quoted, which we don't know how to unpack. Kol davar shu toeles o tikon lekahal o lerov hakahal. Right? That's where the phrase appears. So we're not sure how to unpack that yet. Ned?
But you can give another way to read that. It might become to modify. It's a tikkun or a toilet for the entire gaal or for the majority of gaal. It's not a third category. It's modifying the previous name. The gaal or the gaal.
I mean, is a tikkun or a toheles?
For either the entire gaal or for the majority of the gaal.
Ah, so the gaal, you mean everyone?
Yeah.
Meaning. But that's how the Pesachei Tshuva would be reading it, right? Meaning, it's got to be for everybody or for majority. But if it's for miyotakahal, that's not a. It's a controversial reading though, because you might say lekahal might be the kahal at large, right? The abstract entity that is the kahal, without reducing it to the set of individual constituents, the full set of constituents.
I mean, there might be certain.
So everybody see that? So I think what Ned's suggesting is this phrase, tikkun lekahal o lerov hakahal, means either the all or most of the community. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm saying that's not obvious because tikkun lekahal can mean. So there are two. Kahal is ambiguous. Does it mean the individual constituents of the community or does it mean the community at large?
It means the community at large. The question is, what does that large mean?
Right, so you're interpreting it to mean every constituent. Right. That's how the Pesachei Tshuva read it. So I see that? As opposed to saying, oh, this is good for the community, even if,
which is consistent with it being good for me as the community. Right? Two different ways of reading that. Yeah. Okay, so that's a fair point. Okay, go on, Zachariah.
Yeah.
Take us into this phrase.
So, Vyomar, Akhir al Hatos, Kash Maskim Haro, Afisha Miot, Misnagim, Nirul Henshitan Oseam Chazakos. Are you the tail of the rope?
Okay, so let's think about this for a second.
Right, so you should justify the fact of majority. You say, Akhir Am Lahatos.
Okay, so Akhir Am Lahatos, where does that phrase appear?
Parshas
Mishpatim. In what context?
Dayanim.
Yeah, that when you have a dispute in a Bezdin, you follow the majority of the Dayanim adjudicating the case. How is the Mari Bruna using it here? Majority rules for communal decisions. Right? So he's taking that concept to explain why should we care about majority das rov? What's the halachic significance of that? So he's saying, well, we know the Torah in other places defers to the majority. So the way I would understand this is that maybe that shows us that in general, whenever you have a collective voice question, what is the voice of the kahal? It's the voice of the majority of the kahal. Now, we in the American system know that there are other ways to do this. For example, what? You have a smalach also sometimes. A supermajority, right, or some threshold. Even a lot of sometimes in the Bezdin case, you need a majority of a certain number, majority of two maybe. But here it just sounds like Akhir Am Lahatos means a brute majority. And what does he give as the theory for why the majority should have controlling power, Josh?
Batel Barov.
Yeah, Batel Barov. Right, so whatever the Miyot claims, they're Batel Barov, which I take to mean how do we get the what? It's just a decision procedure. What's considered the will of the community? The will of the community is the will of the majority of the community. And you put it to a vote, you see who has more. Whoever has more, that's considered the collective voice. Yes? I think that sounds very fair. But you can see he's really working out these problems. So and that this idea of Akhir Am Lahatos does not appear earlier. So go on, Zachariah.
So the Ein Shom Lahem, so we don't listen to the minority. Moshe Ein Shom Lahem in Tanu, Lo Nachmis Orphim, Lo Nechalik Tzedakah, Lo Nazkir Vinyan.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand this when I was looking at Noah. So we don't listen to minority, just like we don't listen to someone who says we're not going to do or have orphan or give out tzedakah or hire him.
maybe the Kmo is not like a comparison, it's like in the cases of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think his point is that let's see. I think his point is that we follow the majority to make the decision. In the same way that decision is binding, we don't give any merit to the miut voices of the kahal. But I agree with you, it's not so clear what that argument is supposed to be doing. Right? Or to put it differently, I think he's saying... anybody else have thoughts on this, actually? I think his point is that there's the same legal principle that explains why the majority that votes against something is overridden. That also explains why... Sorry, backwards. Yeah, he's explaining in the same way that the rove outvotes the miut to make a decision, if the miut is arguing that they don't benefit from something, they're also overridden. So in the same way that rove governs for deciding what the will of the community is, so too... Rove is decisive for determining what the needs of the community are. So if individual yechidim say they don't have need X, need Y, or need Z, that's not binding. So v'chile inyan lechi v'kora.
Inyan lechi v'kora in ton lama etim le'tachkam kedei l'hachnes l'hozi v'shabes ani eni rutsi l'hachnes l'hozi o enum sarach l'hachnes l'hozi. Oh, and I'm trying to speak for everyone. Lukulanu means our lanu kolkach v'tkanazo.
Yeah, so like there's
so if a minority starts trying to speak for everyone.
Yeah,
we don't lose that.
Exactly. Meaning in the same way that we don't care about their individual interests, we don't care about their view about what the interests of the rabbim are. Right. Okay. Well. Yeah, I'm not sure why he thinks that you have to distinguish between these two, but the point is that the majority rules on all of these things. Okay. And then he says here, so this v'ifshar is a nod to the Meiri and the Ramah. So what does he say? So this is walking back a little bit the Achi Rabbim Lahatos as the underlying principle. So walking away from majoritarian frameworks. What does he say?
V'ifshar sh'v'eilu dvar sh'huskru v'mishnu b'raisa av'tusefta kofen achilu sh'lo al-be'eru.
Which is a nice idea. Yeah. So this sounds like he's. What do you get from this? From this.
Giving special status to ones that are explicitly listed.
Yeah. So there are some things for which it's about the view of the majority, and there are other things for which those are individual rights, and every yachid has a claim against the rabbim to be provided these goods. So he's pretty clear that there are two different dinim going on here. Now, for non-necessity, this is like the American system, right? So, some things are up to Congress to decide, where it's literally just the majority view, like what do the majority of the representatives want? But then there are other things that are basic rights that are not up to Congress to decide, and those every yachid has a right to, regardless of what the rabbin wants. Yes? So he has both of those dinim over here. And they apply to different types of goods. Okay. Anything else important in the discussion here? There's one interesting thing here in the mikveh discussion, which we'll come back to. I want to just draw your attention very quickly to this discussion. And then we'll pick up with this next year.
Yeah, so I've got an appointing representative.
Yeah.
When is that legitimate?
Yeah. So the thought here is the community appointed somebody to be in charge of building the Beis HaKnesses. And then now you have people who are objecting to that. They're not happy with how that person carried out his responsibilities. So what does he say about this? And here we move from the question of Ruv to the question of a representative Ruv, right? So what Ariel called the Athenian direct democracy to a representative. So what does he say?
He says, "Aval in minoi afil yafish nesmana mikir pahal unki Ruv minyav minoi lechol davar v'alav amar musim zal yiftach v'lo kishmulta."
Yeah.
Any appointment by all or majority of the Kahal is effective, and he has power.
So, do you guys see that? So, in the same way that the Rabbim could make decisions for the Kahal directly, the Rabbim could appoint an individual who has the power to make decisions for the Kahal, and his voice speaks for the voice of the entire community. Meaning they can empower a yachid as their representative to speak with the power of the Rav HaKahal. So you can see here, Leinyan minui afilu yachid shenismana mipi HaKahal mipi Rav minuyav minui lechol davar yiftach bedoro kishmul bedoro. And here also, he cites the Mordechai in our parak, who cites the Ravya? Im huvru tuve ha'ir mitchila lahanhe kehilam. If a kehila picks like a board to represent them, b'chol davar afilu yachid shebiru masha asa asa b'takanas hakahal. Even if they pick one person to represent them, his decisions are binding. So what do you make of that? So they could delegate their authority to representatives.
I just think it's like he's their shliach. I don't think it's that much of a...
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, right? He's their shliach. That, to me, suggests that the Das Haruv could be... So I guess there are different ways of saying this, but the Das Haruv could be to appoint certain people who get to make decisions on their behalf. Yes? Okay. So what we want to figure out, we're going to stop here, but in the next year we want to try to dig a little deeper into what exactly this communal power is and how far it extends, not just to these cases of Dine Mominus. We want to see if it extends also a little bit beyond Dine Mominus. So we're going to look at a few more tshuvos, a few more discussions in the Rishonim. I want to talk a little bit more about the representation idea, this idea of the tuvei ha'ir, or that they could appoint somebody to speak on their behalf. And then we're going to put this sugya on hold. We're going to come back to this fundamental question of kofen ir zeh, but we're going to go into the discussion of im goven lefi mamon lefi nefashos goven. So we're going to put this fundamental question about communal authority on the back burner, go into the distributional question. And then on Daf Ches, we're actually going to come back to the communal authority question. So we're just going to put it on the back burner for now. So for next year, I would say I'm going to add a few makoros on Tuvei Ha'ir, the representative issue, and then start working on the Lefi Mamon or Lefi Nefashos discussion, the distributional question. Good? All right, sure, guys.